It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The state climatology office is up and running with funding. We examine its projects and priorities as it provides climate information and analysis to Wisconsinites. Join the conversation. Call in with a question or comment for the state climatologist, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Vavras is a Wisconsin state climatologist and a senior scientist at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good to be here.
Good morning. So you learn the Wisconsin State Climatology Office has a funding stream receiving $1.25 million over the next 4 years from the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. And the money comes after the office has operated without funding for a decade. How significant is this moment?
Well, it's very significant. This was a great surprise for us back in the fall when we learned of this funding. And it really enables us to go full force with providing the services that Wisconsinites deserve through the office. As you said, it's been running in volunteer mode for a long time, actually all the way back to 2000. And so now we actually have the resources to get going at full speed.
Oh, for decades then. So this is really, really pivotal. How will this grant money be used?
Well, this grant money will be used to provide the climate services that the office is known for. So that's things like providing information on climate and weather, interpreting information, and also investigating, meaning we now have the capacity to do research to understand Wisconsin's climate a lot better.
What type of research might come from this office that would fill a void that we wouldn't see elsewhere in climate research around Wisconsin?
A couple of ways. So one way is basic research. So that's just sort of curiosity-driven research. One question that's come up just since I've been at the helm here this year is it appears from the data that we've had a significant increase in the amount of snowfall in Wisconsin since records began in the late 1800s by about 1 foot per winter. And so that's a very significant increase, but it's not clear if that's real or if that's just spurious because of differences in how snow measurements have been made over the years. So that's basic research. And then there's applied research. So that's things like a specific question that someone might have to try to, say, improve farming operations. So for instance, can we provide information that would provide them when are the best times to plant or when are the best times to spray? When are dangerous times to spray? So things like that that are very practical and very applied. Those are also information and research that our office can now provide.
Along the lines of practical, I'm wondering, is your funding unrestricted? Can you choose how to use the grant funding?
More or less, but I should give the listeners some background. So this grant was provided in an appropriations bill secured by Senator Baldwin, unbeknownst to us, and it was meant to create what we're calling a new Rural Partnerships Institute at UW-Madison. And the purpose of this grant is to improve the lives of rural Wisconsinites. So it does have purpose in that sense. And the State Climatology Office is one pillar of this. There's a new Wisconsin MesoNet, so a coordinated network of weather stations is another component. And then a third component is a set of collaborative projects between UW-Madison researchers and rural communities that's still being fleshed out. So there is this overarching Rural Partnerships Institute with a mission to improve the lives of rural Wisconsin residents, and the State Climatology Office fits into that.
To that whole new model, if you will. Steve Vavras here as we talk about the Wisconsin State Climatology Office, and you can join in with your questions and your comments for the state climatologist, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, what is the landscape out there for climatologists? Do other states have these types of offices?
Almost every other state does have a state climate office. They're funded in different ways. They have different points of emphasis. For instance, Iowa is part of its agriculture department, and so it very much has an ag emphasis. In Minnesota, it's funded through the DNR. But almost all states, Massachusetts is one of the rare ones that doesn't have an office, but most states do, and they offer climate services, but each one has a different emphasis. And so Wisconsin, by virtue of this grant, does have a little more leeway than most states. For instance, we're not housed within the DNR, for example. And so we do have a longer leash to decide exactly what kind of climate services we're going to provide and which items we're going to emphasize more than other states.
Why should these offices be part of state government?
Well, we provide a lot of important information to state agencies and Wisconsin residents as a whole. And one great example of that right now that's very timely is the drought. So we've recently activated the Wisconsin Drought Task Force. This hasn't been activated since 2012 when we had the terrible drought that summer. And the Wisconsin State Climatology Office is an important player in this. So each week we're meeting with groups of other representatives from other state agencies, and we're providing briefings on weather and climate conditions in Wisconsin. And ultimately, through these meetings, the task force is providing guidance to the governor's office for decision making as to whether to relax, say, water usage or relax environmental restrictions during the drought in emergency situations like this. So this is something that has been difficult for the office to provide without resources up to now.
Do you know the last time the Wisconsin State Drought Task Force was last activated?
It was in 2012 when we had a very severe drought, even worse than we're having this summer. And so the that was the last time, and then probably the time before that, I'm guessing, was 2005, the last time we had a major drought in the state.
So the synergy here. The State Climatology Office, it remains affiliated with UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and is housed in the Nelson Institute, where you work also as a senior researcher. What about proximity and how helpful is your location?
Well, it's very helpful. So we've been in the same physical office all these years, even without a source of funding, and so that's been very convenient. The Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences has been very generous in providing us with that space and continues to do so. And so we have the physical space we need, and we're also going to be expanding staff, which is going to be very helpful through this grant. And so there's the human resources. So we're soon going to be hiring a communications and outreach specialist. We're about to hire sometime this year a full-time assistant state climatologist, and we're also enabled to have funding to support students, both a graduate student and undergraduate. So we'll really expand the capacity now, and by virtue of being in our building with lots of other meteorologists and climatologists, there will be considerable synergy in addition to our affiliation through the Nelson Institute.
But going back to those rural partnerships, how will you ensure you're also hearing outstate Wisconsin in rural areas?
Right, so we're trying to cultivate relationships right now. So through my contacts at DATCAP, for example, through meetings with individual farmers, and also through the Rural Partnerships Institute, through I mentioned these collaborative outreach projects that are happening. Those are various ways that we're trying to get input from the ag community. In addition, we have support to develop a climate summit during the first year or two of our operation. And the goal of that is to bring in voices, find out from people, both farmers and other stakeholders in Wisconsin, what exactly they want from this office. They may want climate and weather information, but in what format, what types of information would be most useful, and are there any products specifically that could help them as decision support tools to benefit their operations?
Climate Summit, we'll be watching for that. State climatologist Steve Avaris here, fielding questions on climate impacts on Wisconsinites. And you can join in at any point, call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the Wisconsin State Climatologist. The work involves studying long-term patterns in weather, helping us make sense of climate change and its effects on life in Wisconsin and our economy. You can join in your question and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. State climatologist Steve Vavris is here, senior scientist at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison, where the State Climatology Office is housed. Steve, what about advocacy? Your office provides all this historic data on weather and climate trends. Is there space, is there a role for the office to advocate for policies in response to climate change?
I think that's a slippery slope. I would much prefer that the office stick to the bread and butter of providing climate services. And even in fact, when we're somewhat limited in our purview regarding climate change, so certainly any historic climate change is fair game for our office to address, and we do that. But when it comes to future climate change, our close partnership with WICI, the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, is a natural. And so they can handle these questions about where Wisconsin's climate is headed in the future and what the impacts are for our state. So I think by having a more limited purpose, the State Climatology Office can meet its mission more effectively.
Okay, WICI handling the forecast ahead, that housing the crystal ball, if you will. Right. It's interesting because we talked with you in September about intense rainstorms and excess water in the Great Lakes. And now here we are, the state under drought. Is climate change causing these conditions, these extreme conditions?
I think that's a question that's on everybody's mind right now, especially as we have these record heat domes building in the far southern part of the country. One of the things that we do expect is that climate change will deliver more hydrological variability, so more intense rainstorms, but also a tendency or a likelihood of more drought. And we've seen both examples this year. We had record precipitation from January through April, and then suddenly we went through our third driest May-June on record in the state. Whether that will continue for the rest of the year, this flip-flop back and forth, remains to be seen. But climate models do suggest definitely more intense rainstorms in a warmer climate. But going hand in hand with that is a likelihood that we'll also be seeing, we meaning globally, more instances of drought conditions. Concern here in Wisconsin is so-called flash drought, these droughts that come on suddenly, like we've seen this year. And this is actually similar to what we experienced in 2012.
I think you called it weather whiplash to the Wisconsin state farmer. How concerned are farmers with these dramatic shifts?
Well, farmers are a resilient lot, and they do great things in coping with what weather brings them. But this year has been challenging. So we had so much snow in the winter and spring rains, and now suddenly into the dry spells. And so farmers have a lot of experience in handling weather variability. And the types of crops these days, these hybrid crops with the newer genetics, are much more able to handle drought than even 10 years ago, and certainly compared with, say, the drought of 1988. And so they can handle a lot, but this is challenging. This is definitely a challenging year. And depending on where they are, exactly whether they've hit some of these spotty showers and thunderstorms or not, that really determines what kind of shape their crops are in right now.
We've been talking recently on our program about El Nino conditions, which forecasters are saying is expected to continue strengthening, and it's occurring earlier than usual. Do you have your eye on these on the El Nino weather patterns?
Definitely. So El Nino is emerging. So this is an unusual warming of the Pacific Ocean waters, happens on a time scale of cycle of every roughly 2 to 7 years. And so we were due for one. And we're it looks like we're going to get one in a big way this year. And they typically strengthen the most during our Northern Hemisphere winter, when they have the biggest impact on our weather. And so I'm definitely keeping an eye on this, as most meteorologists are. And here's a case where the office can be really useful, because there's a lot of, I think, simple-minded thinking about how El Nino affects our weather. A lot of people think if we have an El Nino winter, it will be mild. That's not necessarily the case. If you look at enough winters, you see that there is a tendency to be milder in Wisconsin during an El Nino, but there are lots of counterexamples, times when we had an El Nino and we were not especially warm during the winter. And so this is where interpretation services provided by our office can be very helpful.
Talking with state climatologist Steve Vavris, co-directs the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, and you can join in with your question for the state climatologist at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned earlier about mesonets and the Department of Agriculture helping to pay for a statewide network of weather stations. How will that project provide real-time weather and soil data, and then, you know, help farmers, but also help the projects that you're involved in?
Yeah, the emergence of the Wisconsin MesoNet is a huge benefit from this USDA funding. So this is going to be providing a weather station, a sophisticated weather station, providing lots of different data on temperature, wind, humidity, sunlight, soil temperature and moisture, to every county in Wisconsin, and then some. So the idea is that 90 stations will be rolled out in the next few years. This is a project being headed up by Professor Chris Kacharik at UW-Madison. And these mesonets provide real-time weather conditions. And by real-time, I mean every 5 minutes they're updated. So it's super useful. And it's very accurate too. And so the information will be especially useful to farmers across the state, because they'll have real-time information from a weather station near their particular farm. But it'll also be useful for others as well, other stakeholders. And the State Climatology Office, even though we won't be running the MesoNet, we will be a close partner in disseminating that information via our website and social media. And I'm also looking forward to using that data to provide research projects or decision support tools that can be useful for farmers. For example, there's something called an Animal Comfort Index that's come out of Kansas that uses their MesoNet information to tell farmers when their livestock are under heat stress and how much heat stress, based on that weather data. And I would greatly like to see something like that come out of our office to help dairy farmers in the state.
These weather stations also measuring wind. I'm wondering, could this data help inform where to put up wind farms and wind generation in our state?
Yes, it could. That would be another practical application. So having detailed wind information would be very helpful. And as listeners probably know, wind is something that can vary a lot from one location to another nearby location, simply on the basis of tree cover and elevation. And so having this kind of fine scale weather information county by county would be super helpful for things like wind energy, and also questions about spraying herbicides on crops. So, for instance, South Dakota's climate office obtained funding from the soybean growers to develop an online portal that informs farmers whether it's safe to spray their herbicide or whether it's too windy for doing so safely. And so this is another practical kind of tool that can come out of state climate offices.
You know, climate change has this history of being such a polarizing conversation, a polarizing topic. How will you work to build trust in climate science?
Well, our office is certainly about climate. It's in the name, but we're also just as much about weather, meaning near term, the here and now. And that really is our focus. As I mentioned, the future climate change is really more the purview of Wiki. But what we're doing with climate services in our office is focusing on the present. So, for instance, what's the status of our current drought? When is it likely to break? How can we put that into historical context? But also, what's the climate been like during, or weather and climate it's been like during the past year, the current season? And then what's the outlook for the next month or the next season? So, things that are really practically important for, say, farmers making decisions about their crops, whether to when to harvest and when's the best time to spray and so forth. So we're really more about the here and now rather than the long-term future climate change questions that can be polarizing.
Steve, thank you for joining us.
Happy to, Kate. Thank you.
Steve Vavras is Wisconsin State Climatologist, Senior Scientist at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about art, perfect for road trip season.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from listener Chris Murphy from Madison.
My question is, why are there a higher concentration of outsider artist environments in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the U.S.?
Great question. WPR's Tim Peterson asked a few experts to answer Chris's question.
Nick Engelbert's Grand View in Hollandale, Wisconsin. The Paul and Matilda Wegner Grotto in Monroe County. These are some of Wisconsin's artist-built environments. Ornate, meticulously assembled artworks on a massive scale using concrete, glass, auto parts, you name it. Here's Courtney Anderson Kramer, PhD candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Art History, who researches concrete sculpture gardens in the Midwest, like the Wisconsin Concrete Park in Phillips.
In general, a outsider art environment is going to be a space that is an artwork that is monumental in terms of its size and the amount of time that took to make, but also it can be monumental in the number of parts. So we're talking about the Wisconsin Concrete Park. Well, there are hundreds of sculptures on this site that the artist Fred Smith created over the course of decades.
Anderson Kramer says another example that was really influential on other artists in the region is the Dickeyville Grotto.
It is a monument to patriotism as well as Catholicism, and it is a sort of architectural grotto shrine that is encrusted with everything from geodes and rocks to Ford gear shift knobs, and the texture of the space is just stunning. It's like walking into a gem. It's beautiful.
Laura Bickford is an associate curator at the John Michael Kohler Art Center. She says this genre, like any art, is a cultural contribution and worthy of preservation.
These sort of art environments, I like to think of them as a genre-busting genre, where they're really made by people across walks of life who ordinarily maybe wouldn't feel that they were able to make works of art or wouldn't have access to a museum. And so they can really speak to a true way of the way that people are living on the land that they're living on.
And in the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin, in the early 20th century, people wanted to share their truth in the medium of concrete. And here's Anderson Kramer again.
At this time, you know, the 20s, 30s, even into the 40s, people are going, they're getting a bag of cement, and they're creating a garden border. They're creating a bird bath. They're creating bird houses out of concrete. So it's very much a part of gardening itself, using the concrete in the garden to make your garden beautiful. It just so happens that these artists really were bitten with the concrete bug and just continued to grow in their confidence, creating sculptural spaces, architectural spaces, adding concrete to their homes.
But is Wisconsin a leader in this type of art? Anderson Kramer says there's not really a concrete answer.
There's some truth and some not so truth to that. You can find these sorts of artworks anywhere in the world, but there are organizations in the Midwest, especially in the state of Wisconsin, like the Kohler Foundation, that has done a great job of taking care of these sites. But then there is some truth to it that there are a lot here, and that's owing to tourism at the time. You think of around the 30s and 40s when these are being made, we're seeing lots of tourism to the Dells, to Door County, and homeowners are kind of capitalizing on this traffic, creating artworks that are driving people to their homes.
Laura Bickford says downloading the map called Wandering Wisconsin is great for navigating to these sites. Though, she admits, the best way to find them is to never take the highway.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on outsider art in Wisconsin, and a longer segment aired on WPR's Central Time. And that story idea? Well, it came to us from an audience question as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers who track gun violence find the murder rate falling across the country. Milwaukee following suit with a double-digit decline in homicides so far this year, those statistics from the Milwaukee Police Department. But can you say it's a trend, and will it continue? Call in with your question or comments about crime. The number to be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeffrey Fagan is here, professor at Columbia University's Law School, studying policing, crime, gun control, and race. Jeffrey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've seen these news reports, criminologists noting this positive trend this year with the murder rate in the U.S. falling by more than 10% so far this year. In Milwaukee, homicide rate is down almost 30% from last year. What is your explanation for this drop?
Well, it's not the first time we've seen a dramatic drop from a recent peak in the homicide rate in the U.S. These things tend to run in cycles. And over the past, I'd say going back to the 1960s, we've seen very distinct cycles of sharp rises and then followed by sharp decreases in the homicide rate. There was an increase in the 1960s through the early 70s, another increase in the late 70s into the early 80s, a sharp decline up through about 1985, then another spike in the late 80s into the early 90s, which was around the time of the crack epidemic. And then after 1993 or so, the rates just fell and just kept falling and falling across the country, in the cities across the country, and stayed pretty low up until the pandemic. And just at the moment of the pandemic, a little bit before, actually, homicide rates started to spike up, and that was in 2020. And now in 2023, we're seeing the same sharp decline that we saw in 1993 and 1981 and 1972. It's just a cyclical pattern over time.
Do researchers like yourself try to connect the dots on these cyclical patterns and be able to explain them further?
It's really hard to do. There's a lot of variation from one city to the next. This is mostly a city phenomenon. The best explanation that for me, others may disagree with me, is that each one of these things tended to coincide with a public health crisis of one sort or another. So in the 1960s, it was a heroin epidemic, coupled with a lot of social upheaval in the 1960s in the cities around the country. In the 1970s, it was the emergence of cocaine markets in the U.S., and these were primarily at that time street markets, and the street markets were very volatile. But also there were, again, other economic dislocations in the late 1970s from the oil embargoes and unemployment rates and high inflation. And so there's a lot of multiple causes operating. And the crack market was pretty much the same. Following a stock market crash, then The emergence of the street market and crack cocaine, which again was even more volatile than the earlier markets, the homicides there rose. And then they collapsed pretty much as the crack epidemic collapsed. If you skip ahead to the pandemic, this is another disease epidemic, but it was of a different sort. But it still had the same social and economic dislocations. And so we see very kind of the repetitive pattern of the context, the enabling factors in cities and the sort of the socio-political environment in the cities, followed by rises and then falls. So, I tend to think of it, and I think others do, as something of a contagious epidemic, like a flu epidemic or any other kind of disease epidemic. And they rise and fall in kind of a cyclical or natural pattern. And at some point, as we say in the contagion field, you run out of susceptibles, and everybody who's going to get involved in violence, or everybody who's going to pick up a crack pipe, or everybody who's going to buy heroin on the street, they all saturate, and then they're gone because there's nobody replacing them. So it's we call it a period or a cohort effect or an epidemic effect, but it's a very, very discernible, measurable process. So most of, there's been a huge homicide decline starting in the late 2022 and into the current months now. And just it's important to keep in mind that somebody in a city may say, well, we're not experiencing that kind of decline. So these things don't happen at the identical same time in each one of the cities. So mm-hmm. It's important to bear in mind that this is a trend, but everybody comes sort of phases in at a different point in time. But the broad trend is present. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to just back up a tiny bit here to 2020 and play some sound. There was this forum hosted by Concordia University last month, and Milwaukee's Assistant Police Chief Nicole Waldner cautioned that statistics need to be looked at over time.
We have to look at it in a large increment of time. And the problem is 2020 changed everything. Like 2020 can't even be considered because nothing was normal, right? And so now we have this 2020 in the middle of these statistics that's messing up everything else.
Messing up everything else. How clear of a picture do analysts have of what's happening? And then how do you deal with 2020 and the COVID pandemic?
I think if we look for commonalities between 2020 and let's say 1988 or 89, It was a disease epidemic. The disease epidemic, in one case, it was a drug epidemic. In another case, it was a disease epidemic. But each of them resulted in very sharp social dislocations. And the economics of it are interesting also. If you think about 1987, 1988, the stock market crash, which was felt very heavily in New York, where I live, in 1987, had enormous social dislocations and economic dislocations, which sort of weakened the natural resilience of communities because fewer people were working, fewer people had those kinds of stakes in their everyday economic lives. And if you cut ahead to 2020, the economic and social dislocations from lockdowns and shutdowns and people falling ill and very high death rates is pretty much the same. So the underlying sort of health dynamic of it is somewhat different between a drug epidemic and a disease epidemic, but the effect on the body politic and the social body, was very much the same. So I don't know that 2020 is that much of an outlier in terms of the explanations, in terms of the underlying theoretical framework.
Interesting. Jeffrey Fagan there, professor at Columbia University's Law School, studying crime, our guide to taking a closer look at the murder rate across the nation and in Wisconsin through time and what's happening now. You can join in at any point. Call with your question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Crime analysts, they say the murder rate in a number of large cities is declining so far this year. Milwaukee experiencing this big drop in homicides as well. And we interpret the reports, explore it in the context of history and how to address gun violence. And we have Columbia University Law School Professor Jeffrey Fagan as our guide. You can join in at any point. Call with your question, your voice, your comment, 800-642-1234. Jeffrey, the Washington Post reporting, there are more guns than people in our country. How much does the prevalence of guns affect our country's murder rate?
There's a lot of disagreement about that. I think the evidence tends to tilt towards saying that increase in access to guns as opposed to supply of guns, and they're correlated, but mostly access to guns, has a bigger effect. I think when the gun market, it's the legal gun market itself expands, there tends to be some spillover or leakage of firearms into the hands of folks who probably shouldn't have them. Or couldn't get them through legal channels. They may be perfectly law-abiding, safe people, but they didn't get them through legal channels. But I think it's important to keep in mind that the supply of guns in the U.S. has gone up steadily. The number of background checks, if you sort of, you can chart those data from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The number of background checks has been going up consistently and almost in an uninterrupted way over the past, I'd say, 10 to 15 years. Now, let's say at least the last 10 years. And throughout that period of increase, the homicide rate was pretty flat for a long time. And really, it really only spiked up in the last decade. At the moment in early 2020, when we were hit twice with social dislocations or social disruptions, both from political protests and also from the disease epidemic. So I think it's important to think about the portion of the legal gun market that seems to spill over into the illegal market or illegal hands, as opposed to the totality of the gun market itself.
Hmm. Chief Waldner in Milwaukee's police department saying there are more lethal weapons on the streets. Is that having an impact on the homicide rate?
Well, it could. I think it has an impact on the mass shooting rate because those tend to be very high-powered weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But every day, most murders are not mass shootings. Most murders are by handguns and interpersonal disputes. And the firepower of those has increased somewhat, but not nearly as much as it is in the higher-powered weapons, in long guns, for example. So I don't know that we can say that. I think one way to think about that is how many people, what's the rate of, that we call the case fatality rate? What is the rate of death per shooting? And we don't have great data on the number of shootings, so we really can't calculate that. We can calculate the number of firearm deaths according to data from medical examiners, but we don't know the total number of shootings. I don't get the feeling, at least in my city of New York, that the case fatality rate is changing. It's remaining, even though the total number of murders is declining, the total number of shootings is declining, the case fatality rate is remaining pretty much the same, which suggests no real difference in either the situation, the context of the conflicts that lead to these deaths, or of the firepower of the weapons that are being used.
You're having to piece together, it sounds, different statistics and bodies of information. Can you talk a little bit about primary sources of this information and the difficulty to have a clear picture and how much crime and homicides are out there in our country?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The main, of course, there's two main sources of information about shootings. One is the police. And most police departments, particularly in large cities, are very careful in recording the number of shootings, as best they know. There are some shootings that don't get into the police view because they might be treated privately, a small number. The other source is going to be medical information. And there, it's an interesting dilemma. We don't really know. We know how many people die because medical examiners will issue reports and they'll make a determination that the cause of death was a firearm or gunshot wound. But we don't know the number of people with certainty who are shot and who show up in the emergency departments or admitted to the hospitals from gunshot wounds. Those data are very individual by state by state and often county by county. We get a sense of that if we look at insurance data because the hospitals all file for payment in one form or another. And so there's a national reporting system, the International Code of Disease, the ICD system, which people follow and they code things consistently. So we can get a sense from some ICD data, from public health data, about the rate of people being admitted to either emergency rooms or to hospitals for gunshot wounds. So that's a second source. But other than that, there's not really great systematic data that covers every place. And that emergency room data is not consistent across the country. Some places, smaller states in particular, just don't report it.
Wasn't there supposed to be this big push for a national system, a national incident reporting system to provide uniformity?
There is. There's the FBI's put out and implemented the NIBRS system. It's called National Incident Based Reporting System. There's some problems with NIBRS being implemented consistently across the country. Not every police department and not every state has implemented NIBRS. It's a much more demanding system to fill out the NIBRS information and complete it. There's a lot of data that they want there, and it's good data. I think the design, the architecture of it is quite good, but as its predecessor, which was the Uniform Crime Reports, getting participation by police departments is difficult. Sometimes it's just a problem of human resources, the number of people who are going to be able to fill out those forms as opposed to being on patrol or doing other duties. So it's good where it's in place. It's not in place everywhere, and it gives us a somewhat truncated or attenuated picture of particularly of firearm violence.
Jeffrey Fagan, professor at the law school at Columbia University, as we look at the homicide rate in decline this year and what to think about it. 800-642-1234. Mike in Shell Lake. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Yes.
Hi, Mike. Yes, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
What I'd like to say, addressing gun violence, until we address how we raise our kids, teach them consequences, and show them that there are actual penalties for what they do, this isn't going to change. I mean, you have Chicago, strictest gun laws in the nation, and it just keeps on going. I mean, I've got firearms, quite a few of them, actually, and I've never come home and had them going off by themselves. There are consequences for what you do, and we don't teach anybody that anymore.
Mike, thank you. Mike, bring this back to values and teaching those consequences. Jeffrey, go ahead.
I think that's, you know, it's an important point. We don't really know as much as we could about the people who were actually doing the shooting during the period when the homicide rates were spiking up. And equally important, we don't really know about why people have set aside these kinds of options or have access to guns but aren't using them. We don't understand fully the decision-making process. And for some people, the presence of a gun is going to lead to a much greater probability that the gun will be used. For other people who do appreciate the consequences, as the caller says, the presence of a gun won't lead to its being used in a hostile or aggressive way. And trying to understand the conditions that lead people to make those different kinds of decisions. Some of it is family. Some of it is temperament and personality. Some of it is context, where you feel that you have no choice but to use a gun because the other person may have a gun. The caller is right for some portion of the population, but I think the broader picture is that two things. One, the presence of a gun actually sort of changes the way people make decisions, even if they don't want to, because it's either me or you if you feel that the other person is armed.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us. Jeffrey Fagan, professor at Columbia University's Law School, studying policing, crime, guns, and race. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.